Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in view, but the sun is eclipsed by the moon.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
Evening, Ben. Hi, everyone.
Hello, everyone, indeed. And as ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number this evening is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can catch us, of course, live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. And we're going to start with what to see in the sky, but we will very soon get to the big news item of the week, which is, of course, the planned launch of Artemis II, the return to the moon. But we'll get to that in a moment.
Yeah,
John, the night sky, as it is, notwithstanding the grand stretch of the evenings.
In the evenings, yes, marvellous. Now, if you didn't get a chance to see the International Space Station over the last month, you don't get a chance again until May the 7th. Until May the 23rd, so you can put that in the diary. I didn't get to see it this time at all, for some reason.
I caught it just by accident one evening about a week or so ago.
I do that quite often, but unfortunately, I didn't get to see it this time around. But it doesn't matter, I've seen it loads of times at this stage. It's a fine, fine sight. Now, Mercury and Mars, low in the glare of sunrise just at the moment. Venus, it's very bright, -3.9. And it's gleaming low in the evening twilight at the moment. It's a little bit lower. Each week, look for due west, 40 minutes after sunset. That's this particular week, and it will still be about a fist at arm's length above the horizontal, and it sets at twilight. And Jupiter, it's quite bright as well. It's the one that's up in the high in the sky, -2.2, making it the brightest point in the sky after Venus sets. Jupiter soon shifts to the very, very high southwest, and then moves lower as the evening grows late. It sets around, we won't call it an argument whether it sets at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. That's, but it doesn't really matter if you're watching it. Yeah, you'll see it. We'll call it 3 a.m. or there and thereabouts. So daylight saving time on the western horizon. So of course we did have the clocks changing over the weekend. As you say, a grand stretch in the evenings. Yep. And Saturn and Neptune are unfortunately out of sight in conjunction with the Sun. Uranus, a magnitude 5.8, which is very dim. And it's very, very difficult to see this one without a good telescope or a really, really good pair of binoculars as well. So you really need high power in the telescope. It's a tiny but non-stellar dot, 3.5 arcseconds wide, if you're into the arcseconds world. And you'll probably need a detailed finder chart to identify it amongst similar looking faint stars.
Thank you, John. And of course, just on the planets, I think you touched on it there about, well, you just say, of course, Mercury is hidden in the glare of sunlight, and it does, Mercury does, it is at the greatest elongation on the 3rd of April. I don't think that makes much sense. But anyway, let's get on to the moon in more ways than one. Mm-hmm. We have a waxing gibbous moon at the moment, almost full, 98.3% to be precise at the moment, which is currently on show. It did rise about an hour ago, or thereabouts, depending on where you are in the country. And it will set at 6:45 tomorrow morning, when it'll be up to 99.4% phase. And when it rises again in the afternoon, just about 4:30, it'll be a 99.8%, practically full. In fact, we will have a full moon tomorrow also, but it'll be at precisely at 17 minutes past 7 in the evening, when it won't be visible from here. But to all intents and purposes, we have a full moon, certainly tonight. and tomorrow. And the sun will rise tomorrow in Dublin. That's Wednesday, the 1st of April at 6:02 in the morning, of course. Local or solar noon when the sun is at its highest and due south. That's at 1:28 p.m. And the sun sets at 8 p.m. on the button here in Dublin. A little bit different, maybe up to 20 minutes later, depending on where you are in the country, north or south, east or west. Well, you can't go much further east than Dublin, let's face it. And then we have various types of twilight until astronomical twilight ends and nighttime officially begins at 10:05 tomorrow evening. So that's what you certainly call a grand stretch in the evening. So we'll have 30 minutes more daylight than a week ago, and tomorrow another 4 minutes and 12 seconds more daylight than today, when there will be 13 hours and 1 minute between sunrise and sunset.
Yeah, there we go. Now, Moon, let's introduce you to the Artemis team, the Artemis 2 astronauts. We have, a lot of you might know these at this stage. We have Victor Glover, and he's the Victor Glover is the pilot. Christina Koch is the mission specialist, as well as Canadian Space Agency astronaut Jeremy Hansen, who is also a mission specialist. And we've got Reid Wiseman. He is the Artemis 2 commander. So those are the four. And I watched them being interviewed on the TV there yesterday evening as well. So, yep, things are looking good. Not a lot of people would have known this.
I was surprised. I came across two people today who had no idea. We should, just to remind people, Artemis 2, due to be launched tomorrow. Now, it has been put off twice because they found a few leaks. Perhaps we'll get to that in a moment. But it's due to be launched tomorrow evening, around about 11:25 tomorrow evening, Irish time. And it will contain those four astronauts, and they are heading out as far as the moon, and in fact a little bit beyond it. They'll be gone for 10 days, and this is part of NASA's planned return to the moon landings. Now, they will not be landing on the moon, but they will be the first people in over 50 years to have gone more than a couple of hundred miles above the surface of the planet. So it's a real big... it's a big thing, and it's very important for successive mission. They're going to test a lot of the Orion capsule. This is not just a purely NASA mission, as you mentioned, John. There's a Canadian on board, and the Orion capsule is a ESA, European Space Agency, build and design, and I think paid for, if I'm not mistaken, because there will be European astronauts and future missions. And they will go into a big elliptical orbit around the moon, and further away from the moon and further from Earth than any people have ever gone, including the Apollo astronauts. I was just thinking of this the other day, John. We're talking about there's been 600 people have been into space. Mm-hmm. And most of them, all but 24 of them, have been just a couple of hundred, about 400 kilometers, 250 miles above the surface in low Earth orbit, shuttles and space stations and whatever. But the moon is being about 240,000 miles away. It's actually 1,000 times further those people are going, and the 24 astronauts from the late 60s and early 70s. There's a huge difference. It's not just 3 or 4 times further away from the Earth than the rest are, 10 times or even 100 times. It's 1,000 times further away. I don't think probably too many people kind of realize that the difference. And of course, that means that there's no quick turnaround. I have to bring everything. We'll get to the food, perhaps, that they're going to bring in a moment. And so it is, it's a big deal. You may recall, most of us know the story of Apollo 13, when they were on their way to the moon when the oxygen tank exploded. And it wasn't a matter... Well, they were thinking of whether to turn the spacecraft around and head back to Earth, or whether to... What they eventually did was let it go as far as the moon and slingshot around the moon and come back. I think, well, it was mostly a fuel issue, I think, because your spacecraft, it's moving along about 7 miles a second, mm-hmm. or something like that. And so you need a lot of energy to, you know... They had to slow it down anyway when they got to the moon to bring it into lunar orbit. But I know that was one of the big decisions, and they decided to let the crew go on. It's kind of risky because, as you know, they had to, the command module, they had to shut everything down there, and went into the three of them went into the lunar module and survived in there for a few days until they eventually got back. So, and even then when they headed back to Earth, when they went back into the command module, because it can't go through Earth's atmosphere in the lunar module because it wasn't built for that, it was just burn up. I weren't even sure that everything would power up again. It was just so cold.
Frozy-tozy.
Yeah, and I think one of the astronauts, where they incredibly, one of them wasn't at all well, came down with some fever or flu as well. So anyway.
Now, could bad space weather endanger the Artemis II mission? This is...
Oh yeah, there was a big coronal mass ejection on the 29th, wasn't it? X-ray flare.
Yeah, this is known as an X-class. Now, the X-class are the largest. I'll just go through quickly what the classification system runs with. So they're graded A, B, C, M, or X-based, which are all based on X-ray brightness, with X, of course, being the brightest. So they reckon this one was an X2.2, which was, in its own right, was... extremely powerful, but they did have one back in November the 4th, 2003, with an X-28, which is an absolute monster. And I remember this one because it caused all sorts of blackouts and power grid outages and all sorts of things, and it caused global radio blackouts, long-lasting radiation storms, and damaged satellite electronics. There was masses of damage done. So they were a little bit concerned, I suppose, about whether they should launch, and they probably are, but I think they're feeling optimistic and confident right now, so I think they will probably do it, because they're gone too far at this stage. But we'll know tomorrow. Let's go to the time of the launch again, just so people don't forget.
I believe it's around 11:28. There is a two-hour window. Now, they're saying, with regard to weather, that from that point of view, it's looking good. There's an 80% chance that it'll fly with respect to the weather. So let's hope so. And if that 2 hour window passes and they can't launch for whatever reason, I think there's another launcher window the next day or the day after. And there'll be a few throughout the month of April, of course. I was going to nearly said March there. Time is marching on. But as we mentioned before, I know some people who are saying that the tomorrow's launch window, which I mentioned, begins early tomorrow, or late tomorrow evening from our point of view. But and it's launching, of course, from Cape Canaveral in Florida, which is 5 hours behind. So it's 6:25 or 6:30 in the late afternoon there, which, of course, would be daylight. Now, the other... launch windows throughout the month, most of them are nighttime launches. Now, these windows are picked because of the relative difference of the distance and the phases of the moon and such like. But the next daylight launch window, it will be April the 30th. And there are some people who think, well, if they can't make it tomorrow or maybe the next day, that they will postpone it until the daylight launch, because it is the only second time that this SLS system, space launch system, has been launched, and they would prefer, and I can see the reason why, naturally enough, that you might want to keep a closer eye on it in daylight and monitor it and You know, they send up these fighter jets to try and track it as fast as they could, but of course, even Mach 2 fighter jets can't keep up with a rocket going at the speed they go at. Yeah. We'll see how that goes. You can look at, it'll be on live on, I know NASA have their YouTube channel, and if you look up nasa.gov, I'm sure you get all the information there, or onto YouTube and look for NASA and space.com. They'll be running a live program as well. So if you have your computer or even your phone, go to nasa.gov or space.com, and there's a few others as well. You'll be able to see it live. Oh, and the other thing is, I don't know whether you... depending on which launch, we may be able to... there's a slight chance we'll be able to see it here 18 minutes later.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that, though. It depends on which launch windows they use and what inclination to the Earth's... the equator might only be 5 degrees or so, or something like that. So, in which case, we wouldn't see it. But as you know, the International Space Station is inclined... the orbit's inclined at 51 degrees to the equator, which means it comes as far north as about Cork, somewhere around about there. So, and of course we're only 1 or 2 degrees above that, so we can see it. That's why it's always, from us here in Dublin, it's always to the south of us. But it depends on what inclination they launch it at, and I'm not sure. I do remember one time ago seeing NASA TV, and I was watching a shuttle launch from Cape Canaveral, and it was a summer evening, early evening, and then I went outside 18 minutes later.
There it was.
There you could actually see two bright lights very close to each other, parallel, moving across the sky. One was the shuttle itself, and the other was the recently discarded main fuel tank, which was slowly dropping and was going to drop into the Indian Ocean. But I digress. Let's get back to...
there we go. Yeah, let's just go back to last week when we had a guest on the phone. His name was Kevin Nolan. He was he's a lecturer and assistant professor in the School of Mechanical and Materials Engineering. Huge interest in spacey stuff, astronomy type stuff. And we had a good chat with him last week. Now, last night you went to see him at a lecture.
Yes, basically. Well, what he came in to tell us last week was basically a rundown of his lecture, which was called Big Data, Big Universe. I'm sorry, I don't have the link now for it. I think you can still get it. Anyway, if you write in, maybe I can send you a link. But, of course, I love Kevin's passion for the subject. It's rather... infectious, and he's a very knowledgeable and great speaker, and very entertaining.
Yeah, he certainly knows how to talk anyway. Yeah, we didn't have to do much.
No, he's no, it was a very good talk, and about machine language learning, basically about the new satellites and between the space telescopes and the earth-based telescopes. The new ones, and how much data they can gather, and how much of the sky they can survey in so much more of it in such a quicker time than, say, the Hubble Space Telescope, and all the data that's coming down from them and will come down from them, and how do you get through all that data? Basically, terabytes upon terabytes. Terabytes isn't even the word. I don't know what the next factor up from terabytes is. Pentabytes? Gigabytes? No, not gigabytes. That's smaller. But anyway, you get the ideas. So perhaps, not so much AI, but they will be using certainly machine learning, language learning to crunch the data. But anything that's discovered will get a human eye thrown over it too, rather than just popped out there. But they expect to discover many, many more thousands of exoplanets and asteroids, and the near-Earth objects, which, of course, is something we always we talk about a lot here, about the chances of being hit by some big rock from space, like in one of those films.
not recommended, of course.
No, certainly not, no.
Yeah, so it was an interesting one. And then you had young Mr. Flannery. doing his walk around the night sky as well.
Oh, yes,
like,
he does.
Like,
he gives
what we do here.
Yes, well, he gives a little monthly check, tell her what's coming up throughout the month now to spot the planets and such like.
Yeah, they're all sort of a bit weird at the moment, aren't they? It's, some of them disappeared and some come in for a little while and then they disappear off again as they switch from morning to night and night to morning and all that sort of stuff. So that's why we keep an eye on it.
Well, of course, whether they're in the evening or morning planets depends on what side of, obviously, what side of the sun they're on at the time. So, anyway, at the moment you're listening to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. You were talking about Kevin Nolan and his talk last week. Of course, that is available as a podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, I know you can get it on... I was going to say Mixcloud. Is it on Mixcloud? I'm not sure. I don't listen to it.
There are tons. Yeah, that's the... Yeah, if they... It's always, as you say, wherever you get your podcast.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, there you go. Now, how fast is the universe expanding? I can't give you an exact speed on this, but just up to recently, the local universe may be expanding more slowly than previously thought, scientists have found. And the discovery made in two separate pieces of research could relieve one of the most troubling headaches in cosmology, which is known as the Hubble tension. Now, they only had one reading of this. Now, we do know that we're going mighty quick through the universe. And as we're sitting here, if you add everything up the way that we're going out, we're spinning around, going around the sun, etc., we're doing about 535,000 miles per hour as we sit here. So we hit anything now. We'll end up on Mars very quickly if we're going that direction. So we have a thing called the Hubble constant. And, of course, that was named after Edwin Hubble, the astronomer who found in the 1900s that the universe is expanding. So, and it's the rate of which that is expanding is known as the Hubble tension. So they're putting two of these together. I can't give you the exact speed, but it's pretty quick.
It's something like 7 meters per second per megaparsec. This is the one thing that came up last night, and depending on what method you use, you get a different figure. And this is one of the big issues and talking points in astronomy at the moment. What is the correct figure for? Because it depends which method you use, and you see, you get two different answers, and that cannot be, well, nobody actually knows why. It's all, well, of course, it has to do with relativity and such like, but again, this is going back to Kevin Nolan's talk about one of the things that they hope to be able to crack, I suppose, and how accurate now they can measure the distances to stars. I always thought the distance to star, you know, the parallax method where you look at the angle, you look at the star, a relatively near star, its position relative to the background stars, and then 6 months later, when the Earth is on the other side of the sun, 186 million miles of a baseline, and you use basically trigonometry, measure the angle, and you can calculate the distance to a star, but that was only until recently. The accuracy of precision of measurements was such that you could only measure really accurately anything that would maybe, I'm not sure, only a few light years away, maybe 10 or something like that. I'm not exactly sure, but very few. But now they can measure them to such a degree, the accuracy, they can measure out accurate distances out to, I think it's 130 light years, which includes a few more stars. So that gives you a better... again, idea about how big, well, not, again, it gives you a bit of an idea of how big the universe is. If those stars are, if you can measure that little distance, you can say, well, and you know the ones behind that are vast numbers, factors beyond that.
You just can't get your head around it.
Huge numbers we're talking.
So they have two of these measurement techniques become more precise, but it still troubles them, the scientists, the astronomers, whoever it is, and many astronomers at this stage cite the the need for a third method to help bridge this disparity, or at least some shed on some light as to why it exists. So there we go. As I said, we can't give you an exact speed, but it's blooming quick, and they reckon it's actually, with the new calculations, slightly slower than previously predicted. And then with the third constant, if you like, they reckon that they might be able to get more accurate as to the speed of the universe.
Thank you, John. Now, tell us about Skyfall. It's not another James Bond.
No.
I know you're a mad James Bond fan. Yeah,
this is weird.
This is back to Mars.
How long have we got with this? Oh, we have a good few minutes for Grant.
We have
Skyfall.
3 minutes.
Skyfall. Now, it's not James Bond or anything.
No, okay. No, thank goodness.
Okay. This is the first nuclear-powered interplanetary spacecraft, which will send its Skyfall helicopters to Mars in 2028. And Skyfall will fly on a thing called Space Reactor Number 1 Freedom, which will demonstrate advanced nuclear electric propulsion in deep space. So Skyfall is happening, and it will get to Mars in a totally new way. Last summer, NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the Virginia company AeroVironment unveiled their Skyfall mission concept. And this was only announced, where are we, about a week ago at this stage. NASA announced that the development of Skyfall for a 2028 launch, and that the mission will journey to the red planet on a spacecraft that uses nuclear electric propulsion. This is a new type of thing. I'm supposed they're just trying it now. It can't really go wrong, because with nuclear, once you kick it off, it's going, and there ain't no coming back on that one. So it'll be interesting to see if they do get to do that. Now, 2028 is not that far away. And we'd be looking forward to see how we get on with that as well. So what have they got out there with nuclear? Voyager 1 and 2, do they have a little plutonium reactor in them?
Yeah, to power them.
Yeah,
Because they were so far from they knew they were going so far from the sun that solar panels weren't going to work, and not for long anyway, just too far away from the sun, and the batteries wouldn't last too long either, because they were launched in 1977.
Yeah.
So,
and they're still sending stuff back, although it takes a long time for us to get there, but is it about 18 hours each way, and they're outside the solar system at the moment and whistling through the universe at 40,000 miles per second.
Huh? And that doesn't slow down. No pit stops.
No, that's unless there's
24/7, 365 days a year.
Someone's an alien out there will be, what was that? It's really strange. Imagine coming across something like that. If somebody's sending something to us the other way.
Yes. Right,
we'll also say, what was that? As well. So there we go. So anyway, that's probably just about it for this evening.
To remind you, check out of course, our podcast from last week if you want to hear Kevin Nolan's brief history about the data and the methods of collecting data, how it's going to be interpreted and analyzed and such like. And also, of course, Artemis 2 planned for launch tomorrow, the first return of people in the direction of the moon in over 50 years. 1972, I think, was the last one, wasn't it? Apollo 17. So that's 54 years, more or less. Well, I think it was December, 53 and a half years since people have been that far away.
And won't it be great, because most people will be on their 11 tea break when it launches, so there'll be no arguments there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, 11 p.m.
Yeah, well, yep, there'll be fellas working nightly with tea
breaks. I suppose
there'll
be that 11 p.m. The 11 p.m.
So alarm clocks set, please, and report next week.
We'll bring you the latest. Hopefully everything goes well. I'll be looking forward to it anyway. I'll be looking at it, definitely. And I'm sure John will too. Won't you, John?
Me too, definitely.
Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you, John, for your news items. And that's all from us here. And for myself and John and Ben Emmett, which is me, of course, from this edition of The Astronomy Show. And it's music all the way now until 2 a.m. here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Because up next, we have Dublin's Greatest Hits, followed at 10 p.m. to midnight with Nigel Wood and his Ear to the Globe. with his world music mix. And from midnight till 2 a.m, Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul with a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We will be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening. And say good night, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.